spiritual approach. It's different than the other books of Tanakh. What would you say is the most difficult thing about the Book of Rus? Why is it a difficult book? Or do you find it? I mean, unless you disagree with me, of course, that's okay. But, see, in the book, compare it, for example, to Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther, at least on the surface, of course, there's deeper ideas. You have to study it in depth, and the more you study it, the deeper, you know, the more profound the ideas. But the story itself is something which we understand, pretty much. It's a story of how the Jews fell into a situation of danger, all right, due to the fact that they had assimilated, whatever the case, this factor of the Jews sinning. And then there's the emergence of the wicked anti-Semite, there's the Haman, and then there's the story of Mordechai, which we understand, that the tzaddikim who refused to compromise on the basic principles of Yahadus when it comes to recognition of any form of Avodah Zarah. And this is the story of Amalek, basically. The story of Amalek. The Jews become ensnared by Amalek. And then there's the Nais. There's the Tshuva. The Jews do Tshuva. The story of Esther. And salvation. The Jews are saved. So you basically understand, you read the story, even on a superficial level, and it's something which makes a lot of sense to you. What is the idea of the story of Rus? What's the basic theme? What's it basically trying to teach us? It's very, very, it seems to me, it's a simple kind of a story, and you wonder what exactly is the point. What are we supposed to learn from the book? You know, you don't walk away with a clear-cut notion. As I said, like if you read the Megillah, you walk away with something. That that God, in spite of the fact that the Jews sin and God brings punishments upon them, but God doesn't abandon the Jews when the Jews do tshuva, anti-Semitism. I mean, we understand. But over here, it's not really clear what the underlying theme of the... What is it trying to teach us? What's the underlying theme? But there's also a problem. Aside from that, it seems to me that the story itself, at least from the beginning, the story, there's a famine, and this individual, Melech, leaves the land. Well, why is that important anyways? Well, what's so significant about that? He leaves the land, goes, and apparently that's a very serious type of a sin, because it seems that he dies because of that. And then his sons marry these Moabite women. Then you have what I guess most people would regard as the essence of the story. If I were to, what people think of when they think of Rus would be the story of her conversion. This is very, very important. The conversion of Rus. Rus is a very important figure. She's the great-great-grandmother of the David HaMelech. Fine. And her conversion is very significant. Although, again, when you read the story superficially, it doesn't seem like it's not obvious what's so great about her conversion. We're going to take that up. That's one of the issues, of course, we're going to take up. But that's it. If that's the purpose of the book, to teach us about conversion, because this is the paradigm, this is the model of conversion. I mean, the halachos, many halachos about conversion are based upon Rus. She represents the ultimate in terms of conversion. So the story should more or less end over there. But that's just the beginning of the story. Then you have the whole thing. Then it becomes very difficult. There's a big problem after the conversion. Then they return to Eretz Yisrael, and then what's the next significant event after the return? What's the next significant event? Or the next significant character? It's Boaz. Yeah, she meets Boaz because she's gleaning in the fields. Because they fall into a state of tremendous poverty. So she had to go out to collecting, gleaning just to get the food. According to Halacha, that's set aside, leket, shikha, certain, it was an obligation on the farmers to set a certain point, the stalks that fell off were forgotten, left behind, so that was for the aniyim. So she had to go and collect, okay? And then she grabbed the attention of Boaz, And he comes into the picture. Boaz enters the picture, and he sees something unique about her. It's not really that clear what's so special about her, but he finds something very special about her, very unique about her. He knows about her, and he wants to give her special protection. That she shouldn't, because apparently at that point in time, she didn't have the security of knowing that she could always come to this field. He wants to know she could always come to this field. And then, okay, then the story becomes almost impossible, because Naomi cooks up this strange. Naomi now wants to make a shidduch. It's a nice way of making a shidduch between Ruth and Boaz. Of course, as you know, Boaz was a nephew of Elimelech, was a relative. And so the last two chapters are extremely difficult, because the way she arranges for the shidduch, to for her to go there to dress up in her finest and perfumes and so forth, and to sneak in, because it was the time of the threshing, and he had to be there to guard his properties and to supervise and so forth, and he'd be eating a nice meal, and to find out, to sneak in and to find out where he's going to be sleeping, and to pick a spot right next to him by his legs, and then to sort of start in the middle of the night. He's like shocked to find somebody there, and he discovers that it's Russ. And that's where she's going to basically make her proposal. She's going to propose to him. That Kasha tells us, it's against the pattern. There's certain patterns of Derech Eretz behavior. The Gemara says a woman shouldn't pursue a man. It's the Derech of a man to pursue a woman. Okay. But that's strange. This is it doesn't seem to make any sense. What was the point of that whole plan? And the Boaz, after he recovered from the shock, seems to be agreeable to the idea. So if that's the case, go about things in a normal way. You set up a normal way of arranging a shidduch. Why was it necessary? That's something which very hard to understand. Comes out of nowhere. It's not the kind of behavior we'd expect in a tzaddikus, someone who's modest and so forth. It seems like wild. And then, of course, the most difficult problem is the problem of the marriage. There's nothing wrong with the marriage itself. If the idea of marrying, other than the fact that you have to realize that Boaz was significantly older. He's significantly older. I think the Chazal say he was about 80, and she was about 40. So, okay, it's a question. It's not impossible, but to get around that. But you know that there's something more significant, because this marriage has the character of some type of a redemption. It has to do with redeeming the fields that belonged to Elimelech. And more significant, and that's why Boaz says that there's a Goel. It has to do with Geula, a certain type of redemption. This marriage is not just annoyed. It's not just the case that that Ruth needs a husband, and Boaz would make a fine husband. There's a concept behind it. It has to do with redemption. And in the last chapter, we find that it's it seems to be very much connected to the idea of Yibum, as you're familiar, the Levirate, the marriage, which takes place when a brother, one of the brothers in a family, is married and he dies without children. So then his wife is sort of bound. It's a big, big mitzvah for one of his brothers to marry, to take this the brother's wife in order to have a child, so that his name should not be erased, that his name should remain tied up with the household. Now that's okay. That's a difficult concept in its own right. The concept of Yibum. What's the idea behind that? But here it's a little bit strange, because it's not a true Yibum, as you know. Because what I failed to mention, but which also I think sort of like is something that we have to remain aware of throughout the entire story, is that the original marriage, it seems, there's a problem. Why is it a problem? Even if you to assume that it's a halachic kind of a yidden is impossible, right? Because there's a big problem with the marriage of Rus to Mahalon, right? And that problem is
She wasn't Jewish.
That's sort of, and that's a serious issue, you know, like it's sort of being overlooked. And she is being referred to, though. I mean, it's very strange. It does seem most of the there are some affirmation that indicate that she had been converted before that marriage, but the Rashi doesn't learn that way, and it doesn't seem like the Rambam. It's very difficult to maintain that. The straightforward way of learning seems to be that they weren't Jewish. Rosh and Arpa, the married Machlon and Kili, they weren't Jewish. They were Noshim Moavios. Because you see, afterwards, if they were Jewish, then how could Naomi have urged them to return, go back to your houses? Because they want to go back with her. If they were Jewish, then she would have. There'd been no problem at all. In fact, we do see that according to the way Chazal interpreted, once Rus converted, that's really the story of the conversion. Wherever you go, I will go, and it has two levels of meaning. On you know, on a deeper level, is she's accepting mitzvot, she's accepting yahadus, and then it says vatechtov. She stopped talking to her. She finally, when she saw that she was kimis ametes, what does it say? She saw that she was steadfast. She was very firm, and you know she wouldn't take no for an answer. To go with her, and the Rambam quotes that in Hilchos Isurei Bia, where he talks about Geiros. He quotes that at a certain point, when you see that the person is completely determined, then you have to stop. First, we start out by discouraging them. As you see, first you discourage, and then at a certain point, it's prohibited to discourage. So, of course, we're going to try and understand that too. What's the underlying philosophy of Geiros? Well, what, I mean, is the objective to discourage or to encourage? What's the point? And why, at a certain point, it's prohibited to discourage any further? We'll take that up. But it seems clear that at that point, she goes with her. The two of them go together. So that means to say that she accepted, she converted at that point. She accepted Yahadus. So if you're going to say that she was Jewish before that, so then this whole thing doesn't make sense. This whole dialogue up and back doesn't make sense. That she's trying to, if you're a Jew, then it would be prohibited to discourage her from returning to Eretz Yisrael. She's Jewish, she should go back to Eretz Yisrael. Why are you going to tell her to stay in Moab? Okay. And so that's, if that's the case, then everything becomes extremely, extremely difficult, because you see that what's the purpose? I mean, Boaz's purpose was to see to it that the name, so to speak, that the name of Machlon should not be erased. And through this marriage, he's going to retain his name. He's going to be connected somehow to Klal Yisrael. And without this marriage, he'd be cut off from Klal Yisrael, which is, in what sense, you know, what do we mean by that? What does that mean? But beyond that, why are we so concerned? Why are we so concerned about the Machlon when it would seem that he did something which was a very serious averet? That's something which is very serious. I mean, I don't have to tell you that intermarriage, marrying a guy, is... it's akin to a sin, in a sense. It's like a avodah zarah. So that is the most difficult. If that element wasn't there, if you just had the element of the return and the marriage to Boaz, okay, the plan, the plot of how she was to propose marriage still is problematical, but that, okay, we can understand that, we can work with it. But to me, the most difficult thing is to understand the character of this marriage. What was the idea behind the marriage? That's what I found to be the most difficult idea. That this marriage will somehow connected to retaining the memory of Machlon. Well, what's the point of that? What's the idea behind that? Okay, but those are some of the general questions. And I'm not going to answer that question today. I want to work our way through the book. Okay, there's four chapters. And we'll take it chapter by chapter. I don't know if each chapter will require a separate session, but let's go through a chapter by chapter. All right, let's take a look at Perek Rishon now. Now, in this parak, we're introduced to the main characters. But the story is introduced, it's interesting, by Hibimei Shvot HaShoftim. It was in the days of the... Well, one word over here is clearly superfluous. What's that word? Shafot. It should have simply said, if the purpose of the story is simply to tell us the time, it should have said, Vayhi Yimei HaShoftim. So, like I've always emphasized, you have to be sensitive to all the nuances of the wording. Shafot HaShoftim, the judging of the judges. Extra word. Of course, if it's the time of the judges, what else were the judges doing? That's what judges do, they judge. So Shafot HaShoftim. Of course, you know, there's a famous Chazal over here. Right? Yeah. Very important Chazal. Because it's Vayihi Ra'av Ba'aretz, and there was a famine in the land. Now again, this is not just a historical fact. There's a connection. Vayelech, but let's just think about Vayelech Ish Beis Lechem Yehuda, and a man from Beis Lechem in Yehuda went, Logur. Now Logur implies temporarily, right? Not permanently. He went to sojourn. El Alagersham. Now that's what we say, that Yaakov didn't go to Mitzrayim Lishtake. El Alagersham. He just went there to so he too went to Alagur to just take a little break. The stay Moav in the fields of Moav. Huvi Ishto Shnei Vanav. He and his wife and his two sons. Then it says V'shem Ish Elimelech. He had a name, Elimelech. V'shem Ishto Naami. V'shem Shnei Vanav Machlon V'Chilion Efratim. He based Lechem Yehuda. Vayavos Tei Moav, they came to Tei Moav, Vayyusham, and they remained there. So apparently it would appear from this that Vayyusham is more than Logger. They came Logger, but they remained Vayyusham. Now, what do Chazal say? Chazal say that, what does it mean, Shvot HaShoftim? There's a connection between Shvot HaShoftim and Vayihi Ra'av Ba'aretz. There's a connection. Why? Because, first of all, when something... See, Vayihi Ra'av Ba'aretz, there was a famine in the land, that requires an explanation. What caused the famine? Now, why do I say that requires an explanation? Because, what? Yeah, exactly. A famine... See, a famine in the land, if it's talking about any other people, so it's just a historical fact. And if you want to, if that interests you, to find out what caused the famine, so you have to, you know, inquire about other factors. About the, you know, climactic factors, whatever, you know, and so on and so forth. But if it's Vayi Rav Ba'aretz, if it's talking about Eretz Yisrael, so then there's got to be some type of a chet involved. Because that's a yesod, that's a general principle. The Rambam mentions it. And that's why whenever there's a national calamity, there's a chiyuv to have, as you know, to have a fast, to have a tainus. The Rambam mentions it in Hilchos Tainus that it's a chiyuv d'oraisa, to have a time of tshuva, to do tshuva. And if you fail to do tshuva, so then it's going to get worse because it's a denial of God. You're saying that we're not under the Ashkach. You're saying that Klal Yisrael is no different. You're denying the relationship between the Jews and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. And you're saying that whatever happens to us is purely a matter of the natural laws. So that's why Chazal said, Vayihi Ra'av Ba'aretz means to say that there has to be some kind of a chet. So that now we understand Vayihi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim. That Vayihi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim is on two levels. Of course, it's important to place the story in some type of historical framework, but you know, Tanakh is not history. The primary concern is not to record history, but to teach us ideas. So, what was the cause? Shvot HaShoftim. Now, what's the idea of Shvot HaShoftim? What's the idea? So, Chazal, yes, Rose?
Not only.
Judging of the judges. I mean, there were... The wording itself, you don't have to make it very often. Chazal have to make a little bit of a change, you know, the nuance and how the word is structured, you know, to get to the point. But here it's very straightforward. Shafot HaShoftim. You can translate it that way in English. The judging of the judges. which can also mean, it can mean two things, that the judging what the judges did, or the judging of the judges. You can do that two ways. Simple translation. So Chazal say, it was a time when the judges had to be judged, when the judges were at fault. That means to say that there was a corruption in the judges, and the other side of the coin, and or the people judged the two ideas. The people judged the judges. So then they say, woe to the generation where the people are judging the judges, and the judges have to be judged. Okay, but I'd like to let me just focus on one aspect, the corruption of the judges. Insofar as the corruption of the judges is the cause of the famine. Okay, so the people are punished for the sin of the judges. So let's ask the question of why. What are we supposed to learn from this? What's the idea? I mean, you could ask it as a question. Let's leave aside the idea that the people judge the judges and therefore they deserve. Let's just take that idea in its own right, that the judges were corrupt. So let's say we would ask the question, if that's the case, if the judges are corrupt, so then the judges should be punished. So what's Vayihi Rav Ba'aretz? What do you see? You see a very important idea over here. Yes, Jesse? His point is that if the judges are corrupt, so the people should kick them out. It's not that simple, because Judaism, that's pretty complex. Judaism is not a democracy. The power is not vested in the hands of the Hamon. It's taken away from the Hamon. It's vested in the leaders. The Shoftim are the leaders. They have a lot of power. But beyond that, there is an executive, the Melech. I mean, if the system is running properly, then the king. The king has really executive control. And he's not elected by the people. So, it's not. Your point would be a good point, perhaps, in a democracy, that one can criticize the people for tolerating evil in their leaders. That whether you can or whether you can't, I don't know. According to my point, it might not even be true in a democracy. Yes?
I was going to say one was the natural result of the other. Because the judges were corrupt, then the people became corrupt.
Yeah. Right. That's the point. In other words, what you see from here, I think it's a little bit different. You can question me. Is that Judaism's view in society really consists of two components? There are two distinct entities in society. There's the people, and then there's the leaders, the leadership. Two components. And in other words, because in the view of Yahadus, it's impossible for people to achieve their objective. It's impossible for man to achieve his objective, to fulfill his purpose, unless he's operating in the framework of a system where he needs leaders and teachers and role models to guide him to his purpose. In other words, man by himself will not necessarily come to the good. It's not in his nature. Really, his nature, the average individual, his nature is to pursue his instinctual desires and so forth. And the only thing that saves him is the structure of a society. You have to have the structure of a society, and in the structure of society you have to have a leadership. Without proper leadership, then the society will fall apart. So there's two elements. And of course, this is not to say, I'm not going to go so far, this part, you see, Chazal said both things. Chazal tied the two together. There is a responsibility. The primary responsibility for the welfare of society lies with the leaders, especially in Yadis, that's the whole Torah system. The Torah system was not given over to the Hamon. You do have to have, in order to perpetuate the true ideas, you do have to have an elite, of a group of, that's the Balei HaMasorah, an elite group who have been entrusted, who master the principles of Torah, and more important than that, more important than their knowledge, is their moral perfection. Without that, and I'll show you how that expresses itself in halacha. Now, where do you see a raya for this point in the Torah? If you could think of something, if you could think of a point, a very interesting illustration of the fact that there are two distinct components. We view it distinctly, that there is the people, the masses, so to speak, the ordinary individuals, and then there's the leaders, two distinct groups. You see that in a case with hint with regard to Moshe Rabbeinu. Example. So therefore, what happens to the people can be caused by either a breakdown. Now that I'm breaking it into two components, so something which happens to the nation could be because of a defect in the leadership or a defect in the people. And conversely, in terms of Yeshua, when the Jews are saved, it can be because of raising the level of the people. That's one. But you can also see a case where nothing, no change has occurred within the people, but a change has occurred within the leadership. Where do you see an illustration of that? Bechete Egel. That's the famous case. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu. And the God, it was a very significant moment when God had told them that he's going to destroy the entire people. The entire people were worthy of destruction. Except God said one thing. So then Moshe Rabbeinu came forth and he prayed. And he argued with God. Lo miyom Mitzrayim, the famous argument that why should the Egyptians say that that you took them out to destroy them in the wilderness? That's the famous argument. That if you do so, if you destroy this people, then it's going to be detrimental to your whole objective, and to start another nation from me. That was what God was planning. And Moshe said, no, it wouldn't work, it's not going to, because then it can never be the same. Because the people will say that there's something wrong. That God took them out of Mitzrayim and then killed them in the wilderness and they can't follow the system. So therefore God agreed. But of course the question is, if that is true, at that point it's true, because of that God relented and changed the decree, right? So why was it dependent upon Moshe saying it? God knew this. Moshe didn't tell God anything that God didn't know. Obviously, God knew this all along, right? So, what is the significance of Moshe as expressing this point? Now, the Chumash says in Shemos Lamed Beis, when God by Yomar Hashem Moshe, God said to Moshe, "Ra'isi Yisrael Hazeh, I have seen this people. V'hinei Am Kshei Arfu, they are stubborn people. V'ata Hanicholi." That's the famous words that Chazal based on. Now, leave me alone, so to speak. Just leave me alone. Get out of my way. And I'll allow my anger to kindle against them and I'll destroy them. And I'll make you. Now, most people, takes a person like Moshe Rabbeinu, most people would be thrilled to jump at the chance. I mean, here he's not the founder. He's a very significant individual in Klal Yisrael, the highest, he has that already, that there'll never be another prophet like Moshe. But now, you'll be the founder. It'll be your people. Now, the average individual would say, of course he wouldn't, he'd have to try to conceal his tremendous the thrill that he's been chosen, right? You say, what can I do? Well, God got to, who am I? Who am I, right? But he wouldn't, but of course, Moshe argued against it. Now, Rashi says, V'yata hanicholi, adayin lo shamanu shispal Moshe aleim. We haven't yet heard, what is God saying to desist? It's an expression of desist. Stop what you're doing. But Moshe hadn't said anything yet. V'u omer hanicholi, elakan pasach lo pesach. But here, he gave Moshe an opening. God communicates. Moshe would not have known what to do, because what are you going to do? If that's the decree of God, the people are worthy of destruction because of this chayt. Chayta egel of Odezara. So then what can you do? How do I know? How did Moshe get the idea that there's anything that he could do? So God gave him a Pesach. And what was that Pesach? Vodio shadavar talibo. God let him know that it's all contingent upon him. She'in yispal aleihem, that if he would pray for them, lo yakoli. That's an interesting idea. Mm-hmm. So what do you see from here? That as a result of this tefillah, that means to say that Moshe elevated himself to a different level. That if because what does that have to do? So Moshe will pray. But what about the people? How does Moshe's praying if the people have to be destroyed because of their corruption? So how does his praying going to change the situation? They're still just as corrupt as they were before. But the answer is totally in you. That you can effectuate, it's not going to be the same people anymore. Because the people are defined as the people plus the leaders. Right? So on this level, on the level that they're on right now, they're worthy of destruction. But if we can change that level, then they're not worthy of destruction. And a change can come about through a change in you. Because you are such a significant part of the nation. That was the Pesach. And Moshe realized that there's something that he could do. If he could reach a new level that he had not reached before. And that new level is expressed in the next Pesukim. The concepts that he enunciated over there indicated that he reached a new level, you see? So the level of Moshe has a profound effect upon the level of the people. So you see that's now you can see Shvot HaShoftim. So it works the other way too. That a corruption in the leaders, you see, the corruption in the leaders has a tremendous impact upon the entire people. Because that's the way the system is structured, the people by nature are not going to be in a state of knowledge. It is up to the leaders to set the example, to teach them, to inspire them. Most important of all, though, to avoid corruption. I mean, the wisdom is extremely important. Two elements. Wisdom is extremely important. There's no question about that. But wisdom by itself, you'll soon see, wisdom by itself can't save. Wisdom cannot... People are more affected by the personal perfection, the behavior, the way that people live their lives, the judges, than their wisdom. And here we see the idea of Shefot HaShoftim Vahira, that the corruption of the leaders. Yeah, but there's a specific significance. The Shoftim are not the only leaders. But there's also the other leaders. There's the Melech, there's the King, the political leadership. Okay. Is there something significant about the corruption of the judges? Of the Shoftim. You have others, you have Kohanim, you have Melech, you have Shoftim, there's different groups of people that you could identify as leaders. And I'm just posing that question. The corruption of the judges, it seems to me that the corruption of the judges has a special significance. It could be worse than any other corruption. There's an idea over here. What do you think? Pauline points out very nicely that the primary responsibility of the judges is mishpat. Mishpat means acting correctly, and that there's two different zones, two different areas of perfection in Yadus. One, we use different terminologies. One is what we call Bein Adam Lamakam, your relationship with God. That's more, you'd associate that more with the Kohen, Avoda, dominating, right? Controlling Kedusha. Personal things, that controlling of your instincts. The appetitive, what you eat, the sexual instinct. That's one. Those are areas which we would call. These are the battles. I mean, the battle of fulfilling the Torah really is on two fronts. So one is with the instinctual components, the basic instincts, the taiva. We use the term taiva. And then there's the other area, and that seems to be the area of mishpat. It's a different type of. Justice with regard to monetary matters, honesty, ethics, not cheating, greed, you see, stealing, ill-begotten gain. That's a different area. And now, let's just, there's a little bit of speculation, opinion. Which would you say is the more significant of the two? I mean, so they're both very significant. You can't, I don't mean it in the sense like you have a lot of like today. Reform Judaism says, well, the most important thing is ethics and this and that, and the religious is not that important, you know, so they sort of negate it altogether. I don't mean in that sense. But in a philosophical sense, can we find any evidence, cases from the Torah itself, which would indicate, which, because it's important for a person to know, which would you say is more representative of perfection? Which area? Or which would you say, in terms of your own life, is more significant, more important, more difficult, in other words, to overcome? And really reflects a higher degree. Yes? Aliza Lamoni, who's a Marian maid. See, the real test the real test of perfection is in the area of mama, giving mama, person's honesty. And it's one thing, people see, that's why the breakdown of the judges, like you see it in outside today, it's a special thing. When people find the corruption in the leadership, in any of the elements of the leadership, it has a demoralizing effect. Yeah, but there's something special about the judges, because they represent the idea of Mishpat. They represent that ideal, right? Now, as long as, see, when people, it's not enough for people to hear, this is the correct idea, this is what, when people see that you really value the same things that they value, you value the real value that you live by is the monetary, and therefore you get involved, you get in some kind of a scandal, cheating or whatever, that breaks down the entire. So they say that all the ideas are false. And it has an effect. People accept, unless a person's on a very high level of perfection, but the average person, he's affected by the image of the leaders, that these people really believe in the ultimate good and the ideal. Now, as long as these people are living, see, now it's not so difficult. The ultimate respect is not, you see, the religious is one thing. It's not so difficult for a person to keep kosher. See, the challenge in the other areas is not that difficult, because all these kashrus, a person, it's true, it may be a little bit of a sacrifice, maybe painful, but it doesn't go counter to his basic desires. See, a person, in fact, the person feels good. It's in line with his ego. A person can feel he's very religious. He only eats, he can still satisfy his taiva. He's not really sacrificing anything. But the real ego of the person is centered around money. See, when it comes to his money, he's a totally different person. That's the real test of how a person is. It's not so much in the area of the religious. People can keep Shabbos and they can daven, they can go to shul. It may be bothersome to get up early in the morning. See, but all these things are pains, but then there's a reward at the same time. Then the guy feels like he's a big tzaddik. It's what they say, it's egosyntonic. It's in line with his ego. It's not a... But all of his ego is centered, you see, when it comes like a businessman. A guy's a high-powered businessman. He wants to make money. So he could still be from. He prides himself on that. It's a feather in his cap. He's a, in spite of the fact that he has a demanding schedule, he takes off time, he goes to shul, he davens, he only eats kosher, and he goes out of his way to get kosher food sent wherever he's going around the globe. So he's there. See, it's true, it may be a sacrifice, but he feels good about that. It's not a breakdown of his basic thrust of what he's going after in life. It doesn't reflect his true value system. He's religious. Yeah, but money, that's the name of the game. So when he confronts the challenge in the area of money, where all of his ego is tied up, and it turns out that there's abstract points in halacha that it's usher to do it, to engage in it, because of questions of interest or whatever the case may be, and so on and so forth, that's where the real test is. That's the ultimate test of the person. And that's why we do find that there are many people, they were shocked when we read about this, that people involved in certain industries and they're involved in corrupt things, and we can't believe it. These are the most religious people in the community. Go to shul and yantif and so forth, and in the doctic they would meet. And nevertheless, how can they do this? The answer is, that's where the ultimate challenge is. That's why you see that the Nevi'im, if you read about the all the rebukes of the Nevi'im, they always rebuked the Jews about the oppression of the poor, taking advantage of them, right? Justice, injustice, that type of a thing. That was, you don't find at all where they speak about you weren't kosher enough, you know, the hashgacha wasn't good enough, right? You didn't get a minyan, you missed Kriya Shema. They didn't, you don't read about that. That wasn't the thing. When the Nevi'im, obviously these things are very serious. I don't mean to make fun. I'm just trying to bring out a point. That when they saw fit to criticize, publicly criticize and lambast Klal Yisrael, it was essentially over two things, Avodah Zarah, and in terms of the mitzvos, it was the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, much more tremendous emphasis. In fact, that's one of the reasons why a lot of the Reform today, you say they turn to the prophets. You see that the prophets were mainly concerned with ethics, they weren't concerned about ritual, which is a false conclusion. See, because I don't mean to say we're not choosing one above the other. We're just saying in the realm of perfection, where's the real test? Where's the real reflection of where a guy's at? The real reflection of where a guy is at is when it comes to his pocket, when it comes to his money, his monetary dealings, if he's honest, if he pays his debts, if he doesn't. And not just overt. It doesn't mean he's going to take a gun and go down to the grocery store and steal so he's a tzaddik, but that's overt. Of course, he doesn't want to get caught. That doesn't make him a tzaddik. But there's so many subtle ways, covert ways, you see, of meeting your responsibilities and helping other people and so forth. That's where the real... that's why there's many. The Eilah HaMishpatim, the first set of laws that God gives to Moshe after Maimon Har Sinai is Mishpat. And the Rashi over there says, to teach us what? That you must have a Bezdin, you must have the Eitzel HaMikdash. Because what the Mikdash really represents, Avoda, coming before God and serving God. You see? So it's very tempting, Avoda. A person likes to do the Avoda. A person enjoys the Avoda because it makes him feel, I'll get to the same, it makes him feel cleansed. He's a tzaddik, he's serving God. And then it sort of can provide a cover-up for his other activities because he has this special relation with God. Now, there's got to be a Sanhedrin, a Bezdin. Without Mishpat, there's a whole perversion. That's an essential perversion of your whole relationship with God. I think the point, I just want to review some of the proofs. The point that Eliezer made is very good. I had that down in my notes as well, that the Ramban says, I don't know if everybody heard it before, the Ramban says, you see, both the Dor HaMabul had deteriorated, had corrupted in both areas. In the area of instinctual control, they became corrupt, engaged in all types of animalistic behaviors, the sexuality, especially in the area of sexuality. Right? Then it says, and the land was filled with oppression. So they were guilty of both. They sinned in both counts. Oppression of Ben Adam Lachavero. So the Rashi says, Lo Nechtim Ugzardin, and then Ela Chamos. That as long as they were just indulging their instincts, but they were able to maintain a structure in which there was a basic justice, Bein Adam Lachaver, so they weren't worthy of destruction. Once they broke down that barrier, then they were like behemoths there. They were consigned to destruction. I had made this point before, I don't know if everybody heard it, which I present to you as a possible rias. I think I went over this two summers ago, the first summer we had here. I'll just say it briefly. This case always troubled us, the case of Eved Ivri. If someone has stolen, that's where he's stolen. And so he's guilty of that primary chait, you know, that we're talking about, Ben Lachavero. And he can't pay back, so he sold as an Eved Ivri. Alright, I'm not going to go into the whole concept of Eved Ivri. It's not a true slavery, you know. It's more like a worker. But the halacha is that if he has, we did it this winter, in fact, if you remember, we did it this winter. If he has a wife and children, then the master can give him a shifcha kenanis. A shifcha kenanis is a Gentile slave. She's a true slave. And she's not permitted. A Jew, an ordinary Jew, is not, since she's not Jewish, she's not allowed to have relations with her. But in this case, there's a special heter for the master, for the master to give the shifcha to the eved. What's the purpose? So that he should provide children. They'll have children, and these children will not be Jewish. These children will not be Jewish, and they'll belong to the master. So he'll have more slaves. Yeah, but what's the philosophy, the philosophical reason behind it? Why is the Torah being matir? That's a very serious iser. Why is the Torah being matir that iser? And we saw that is permitted only in a case, you can have another case of an eved ivri. That's where a person became impoverished, he can't get by, and he sells himself. He's not a thief, he sells himself because he's impoverished. In that case, the master cannot give him the shifcha kenanis. So you see, it has nothing to do with the institution of being an eved ivri. Alright, so I want to explain that the pasuk itself has the answer, because it says, Ha'isha viladeha tiyuladoneha. That the whole purpose of giving him this wife is for what? to cure him. That's to cure him of his own defect, because he negated the property rights of others. So now he has to recognize. See, because of his instinctual desire, he had an instinctual desire for something, right? His basic, that's his narsi, he can't deny himself. That's the idea. That's why I'm saying the real perfection is in that area, because that's your whole narcissism, your whole self-love is tied in with the idea that you need it. You have to have it. You have to have it, so you're special. You negate the rights of others. So that's the cure for that is that he has to acknowledge the rights of others in an area where he's emotionally attached. Because emotionally he views it as his, it's my wife, it's my children, by a lot, but they're not his children. How likely, you have to operate, you have to, your decisions, the decisions as to who owns what are made by halacha. And that's why he made his decision on the basis of his instinct. To overcome the instinct, he has to go to the other extreme, so to speak. Ah, so you see, here's a case where in order to cure him of a defect in the area of Bein Adam Lachaveiro, justice, of injustice, the Torah was matir something which is an esser. You see? That's the other area. So it seems to me that that's sort of an indication that the arena of Isser Veheti yields to the arena of perfection in the area of Bein Adam Lachaveiro, in terms of failure to respect the property rights of others. Okay? That's why this is extremely significant. That's why Shefot HaShoftim is the ultimate breakdown. That's the worst breakdown. Even if other elements of society have broken down, but the judges are the ones that supposedly represent justice. They represent the truth, the real idealism of the system. See, not just in an abstract way, but in a practical way. We have to live our lives that way. And even when it comes to our money, the things that most people treasure the most. Even in that area, you see, people treasure... Yeah, now the breakdown of the judges. Because that's the point. When people see that they... Because everybody has this tremendous sense. That's the real battle in terms of perfection. The real difficulty is that there's a very powerful emotional conviction that most people have. And it's probably one of the most difficult things to overcome. You can confront that throughout, you know, at least this segment of your life until you... And that is, you're living in a world where everybody's telling you what the good is. And the good that they're telling you to pursue is not the good that the Torah is telling you to pursue. And it becomes, and you'll see it becomes very hard, go for it. In other words, it's a certain emotional type of good which has to do with some kind of a success, making it, having it, making it. It's a certain very powerful emotional conviction that things, having things, materialism, that's where it's really at. You know, a beautiful house and money and a nice car and the whole, it's not just this object or that object, it's a certain fantasy of a certain lifestyle. The lifestyles of the rich and famous, that's what it is. If I could only win the lottery, a certain lifestyle, and it's a very powerful thing. And everybody, parental pressure and peer pressure, not to blame anyone because that's the way they were raised. It's an unspoken kind of a thing. It doesn't require any justification. You'll succeed, you'll be wealthy, you'll take this job, you'll be making $100,000. That's it. You don't have to ask anything more. If you're making $100,000 a year, you're made in the shade. That's it. It has nothing to do with whether you're happy or unhappy, what you're doing, but that's a very powerful thing. Now the judges represent the idea that that's just a figment of the imagination, that's just a fan. The real good is something quite different. It's a totally different type of a life. It's to be in a certain state that acknowledges the real good, to have a relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and to perfect yourself. Perfection, when a person's in a state of perfection, that's what makes him happy. That's when he has things. Having things doesn't make you happy. What makes you happy is the state that you're in. When a person's in a state of perfection, when he's in line with his own nature, that's when he's happy. So, of course, you need to tell the totally different approach. So that's what the battle is all about. We are all involved in this struggle, and very often that's why where you are is very important. The Elimelech, big mistake. Don't leave Eretz Yisrael. The environment is very important. Don't overestimate yourself. If you, and it's very significant. You can go away, you go places, even the campus too. The campus is if it can be a very dangerous place. It can be a very dangerous place. I don't think it's that dangerous, honestly. I mean, each person's experience is different. I could just say from when I was, I mean, I went to YU, but I also went to NYU. I went to, you know, I was on different campuses. In my experience, it's not these specific ideas of a specific professor about precursors that such a challenge. I was never that, I didn't have the good fortune to meet professors that were so incisive that I was in any danger of being won over to their ideas. Quite the contrary. That's my experience, but, you know, I'm not saying that, I'm sure there is that danger as well. There may be very, intelligent, persuasive individuals who are, trying to convince you of a false philosophy. That's definitely a danger. I'm not making light of that. But I think there's something else. It's the very fact, it's not a specific philosophy on the campus that's a threat to you, but it's the very absence of any philosophy at all. It's the denial of philosophy. It's denial of objective truth. That sense that there really is no truth. It's all subjective. It's what you feel. That has a very pervasive effect upon you. See? That's the ultimate apikursis. Because you don't just believe that there's objective truth, that the ideas of the Torah are objectively true. It's not just because we were raised that way in tradition and we feel that way. These are true. These ideas come to us from God. This is reality, and that's what has a profound impact upon you. That's a tremendous. When you're surrounded by that environment. And so there again, it's the fact, it's very hard if people are living, you see, you can't, it's another, you have to analyze all these deeply embedded emotions, they're not truths, but convictions. It's a very powerful conviction. If everybody's doing it, then there's got to be something to it. And don't say you're not affected by it. If you're surrounded by a bunch of friends and they're all running this, that, to promote their careers and life, this, that, and that's what society is all about, then you're going to be affected by it. And it's going to put you in a state of conflict. You're going to wonder, why am I sitting over here and studying Torah? Why am I being so didactic, so worried about every little thing that I do when I could just, I could promote I could be making much more money if I would only make a few little compromises. I mean, who cares? You know, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. So therefore, you see the importance of having leaders, proper leaders, because they represent the idea. They represent the idea. That's why it's an important idea. That's why you see the Avos, who were the leaders, the founders of Klal Yisrael, they had every material good in the world. The Torah makes a point about that. They had God endowed them with tremendous wealth. But they weren't materialists. They didn't need the wealth. They utilized the wealth to promote the ideas. And the Torah even goes further to say that the wives, the beauty of the imam, they were extremely, extremely, it goes extremely beautiful women. You see that, I mean, from the Paro, he had to make up a story. Paro was the Egyptian, or the Eliot. Abimelech was attracted to Sarah. And it's the same is true about all the imams. Why? Because that was very important. That in terms of people will see that there are great, great leaders, and these people represent the truth. Now, there's always that lingering doubt in their mind. Yeah, well, maybe that's because they don't have, they can't partake of the material. If they had a choice between the two, then they'd go. So they had both. You see, and they chose the truth not because they couldn't partake of the material, but because they had the material, and they, quite the contrary, they said that the material is nothing. The material is just a means to an end. But the real good are the true ideas. That's why when people see the judges, those people who represent the truth, and they themselves, when they have the opportunity, they're on the take, also, so the whole thing is phony, it's just a phony system, and they're just using their power to keep us down. But that reinforces the conviction which they themselves have. Ah, that's the real good. You see, that's more important than the behavior. That's Kiddush Hashem. The behavior of a person is the ultimate form of Kiddush Hashem. When people see a situation where he implements the values in terms of his behavior, in terms of his life, and that's the greatest Kiddush Hashem. Quite the contrary, the greatest Chilul Hashem is when people see that he talks one way and all that, very nice, but then in his private life they discover that he's corrupt. That's it. That destroys the whole thing. That's devastating. Because they don't have, people do not have an independent connection to the truth of the ideas themselves. You might say, well, so why does he behave this way? That's him, the ideas are true. But people can't relate, unless they're very, very highly perfected, they can't relate to it except through a certain image. They need that image, that ego idea. See, that's why I just want to conclude this section, that the Torah took great pains to show you how significant this idea is, Shvot HaShoftim. The Torah took great pains to try and prevent this from happening in establishing the criteria for who could be a judge. Now let's take a where do we find that in the Chumash? The criteria. There's two places, but the one that I'm referring to. Where do we find the criteria? It wasn't easy to be a judge in Israel. In the Rambam, if you go through the Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin, we talked about the requirements that a person had in order to become a judge. Who was the individual, by the way? Who was the individual who set forth the requirements? Yisrael. Yisrael. When Yisrael was the advisor of Moshe, he told him that he can't judge the people by himself to set up a system. So he went beyond that. He told him what the requirements of interesting. It comes from Yisrael. What the requirements should be. Let me read to you the pasuk. It's in Yisrael. It's in Yisrael. Perek Yudches. A pasuk chaf aleph. So Yisrael says, "Vi'ata sechsa mikol am anshei chayil." You shall seek out from the nation men of valor, yirei Elokim, who fear God. Now let's come to the. We're just going to focus on this point, and you tell me what the nuance here. Look for that nuance. Anshei emes, men of truth. That's the most important thing. Sonei batza, haters of. Butza. Butza means like ill-begotten gain. Ill-begotten monetary gain. Now, what is the interesting term over here? What word is interesting? I'm sorry? Yes, sone butza. Well, why do they have to be sone butza? What we're looking for is people who refrain. Right? Men who refrain from butza. That's what we're looking for. But it seems that that's not enough. Why should I have to hate it? Because the Rambam goes further. Sone butza, betza really means gain. It doesn't necessarily mean ill-begotten gain. It just means gain. Ma betza kinara gazachinu. What do we gain? You know, the brother said, Yehuda said that. If we kill our brother. Af mamon shelahem. See, the Rambam goes further. Af mamon shelahem ain't enough halam alav. Even their own money, they don't get nivhal. Nivhal means like excited. You know, people are nivhal. They get worried. They get crazy when they're facing a possibility of losing money. You know, that emotion that gets over people, that comes over people. Below road fin lakabetz hamamon. They don't run after, they don't chase after money. They don't get excited. They don't get excited. Like you see people get excited over the possibility of making money. So what's the idea of sone butza? Exactly. It's more, why hatred though? It should be, hatred is a very strong term. It should be like they don't, what you really mean is the absence. He's going really further over here. It's funny why a hatred. I mean, what you mean is the absence of any attachment. People are not attached to betza. That's really what you're saying, right? That's what you're saying. Yeah. Which you're correct. If they're not attached, if they're not attracted to it, so then you can't bribe them.
No.
They can't be bribed by money. True. They don't have a price because they don't value it. So, but the pasuk really goes further. So is sinna. You see, why sinna? Why must they have sinna? Sinna is like it sounds like a fanatic kind of a thing. Maybe a person has to hate money. What's that?
Sounds like a
refreshment. Yeah, well, right. That does not make sense. Where we expect people to be normal, and now a normal person, right, a well-adjusted person, a perfected person, has a proper appreciation of the value of money. He has a proper appreciation. There's nothing wrong. We don't believe that money is evil. That it, do we? I mean, that's another thing. I mean, you know, all these famous sayings. Money is the root of all evil. I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to think about that. We'll think about it. Clearly, that's not our attitude. We don't have this idea that the money is evil. I don't. That's not true. But the point is, what you're saying is correct, though. In other words, their attitude towards money is not just that they refrain. It's not just one. See, they're in a state of conflict. They have the desire, but they're able to restrain themselves. That's Kovesh Es Yitzro. In this area, Kovesh Es Yitzro is not enough. Because Kovesh Es Yitzro is a Kovesh. You can be Kovesh. That presupposes a certain level of the Yitzro. But when there's always a price. That's when people say, yeah, everybody's got a price. When a person turns down, go back to him again. We just didn't meet his price yet. What do you mean he has a price? That means to say that he does have integrity and he will control himself up to a certain point at which he will no longer be able to control himself. You see? The desire will overwhelm the control. But Sonei Betzei, he can't be corrupted. Why is he hated? Because when a person recognizes what the good is, when a person recognizes what the good is, okay, the true good, not just in an abstract way, but in a concrete way, a real emotional conviction is attached to the good, then he's got to hate everything which really poses a threat to that. There's a distaste for it. It means distasteful thing. That type of greed, in other words, Betzer here would indicate anything which smacks of a greediness, a certain greediness, he finds it distasteful because he recognizes how detrimental it is to us all, to the ultimate good. Yeah? We're focusing over here on the element of money, but it's true, it's connected. That's why, yeah, exactly. Rivka is making a very good point. Now when it comes to honor, it's the same thing. It's not just, I think the point is very well taken, it's not just that they are not seeking honor. That's one thing. The fact that a person is not seeking honor doesn't tell us that much about his underlying nature. He has to run from it. Yeah, that's, very few people run from it. Or if they do run, they're looking behind, you know. That was a famous, you know, with the Vilna Gaon. This guy complained to the Vilna Gaon. He said that all of his life, you know, it says in Pirkei Avos, whoever runs from honor runs after him. Whoever runs towards honor runs away from him. So he's supposed to say, all my life I've been running away from honor. I turned down everything, you know, whatever came away, I ran away from it. And it never came to me. That's not true. It's supposed to come to me. So the only guy says, yeah, you ran away. When you were running away, you were looking behind. You see? So that's not running away. He was just like acting. Okay. That's the idea of Shifot HaShoftim. Now, what's the story of Elimelech? Who is Elimelech? And what happened to him? This is a tragedy, by the way. The opening psukim of Rus, we see a national calamity and we see a personal tragedy. Two tragedies. And whether there's any connection between the two, I'll leave that to you. Who was Elimelech? Who was Elimelech and what was his chet? Because you see that He died before this is the chet. The fact that he left Eretz Yisrael and he went to Moab, according to Chazal, he was punished. Loma nena Elimelech. Chazal asked him. And it's clear. I mean, the Torah is not just Elimelech. It doesn't tell us who he is. But Chazal understood that he was a significant person. It's not just a story about some individual happened to leave Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't warrant a book to be written about him, and not certainly not in Tanakh. Okay, so obviously Elimelech had to be significant. Everybody in the story is very—they're very significant people. So, what was the story? What was the tragedy of Elimelech? Elimelech was a Gadol HaDor. Was a very important individual. Chazal say, and he also was an extremely wealthy individual. He was a wealthy individual. I'm reading to you from Rashi, Vayelech Ish, Ashir Gadol Hoya. He was a very wealthy guy. I guess he was a billionaire. Uparnes Ador. He was one of the leaders, one of the, Parnes is Mefarnes, in other words, one of the supporters. He was a big supporter, okay, of the generation. V'yatza me Eretz Yisrael l'chutzlaris. He left Eretz Yisrael for chutzlaris. Why? Mitnei Saras Ha'ayin. What's Sarayin?
Stingy?
Yeah. He had a defect. It's an amazing, he had a defect. Saras Ha'ayin would be like the opposite of Ayin Tov. The Rambam, interestingly enough, mentions that the judge has to have an Ayin Tov, a good eye, with regard to others. What's a good eye? It means to say that, you see yourself, there are some people that really are very happy that other people can benefit from what they have. They don't have that need that, to keep everything, that greed, that, to keep everything to themselves. Other people have a tough time with that. Sarayin, up to a point they can give, but beyond a certain point, when you're getting down to the core of what they have, it's very sarayin, they can't tolerate that somebody else is going to have their things. They're going to benefit from their things. They're going to lose their own possessions. Apparently he had this defect. He was a tzaddik. It's interesting. It shows you an interesting thing. Al-tam bi'atzmacha, ad-yom osfa. If this famine wouldn't have occurred, then his whole life, his whole outcome would have been different. See, sometimes a person can be a tzaddik, but he's carrying within him a certain defect. He hasn't perfected himself. And amazingly, sometimes it would seem that sometimes you can get away with it, because that is a defect which will only manifest itself in a certain situation. So as if that situation doesn't come along, he was in the fire of death, he was a good guy, he was just helpful, he was supportive. But this situation brought out within him his underlying weakness. Why? Because everybody came pounding on his door. The generation turned to him. He had the money. So now it's a question, see, it's one thing to help people. It's one thing to give tzedakah, but now we're talking about giving up your whole substance. Everybody's coming after you. So now he was put into a tremendous conflict. And what happened? He says, Shehoisa eino tzara b'aniyim habayim l'dochko. His eye, he had a bad eye for all, he couldn't tolerate. All the people were coming for help. So the whole generation, the people were dependent upon him. That was too much. L'kach nenash, therefore he was punished. So it's interesting, I mentioned before, you see an interesting thing from this. He was faced with a conflict. Alright, so he had this emotion. I don't think it means, he wasn't punished because he had the emotion of Tzarai. Because he had that, if that's the case, he shouldn't punish before this event ever occurred. Right? Just for having that emotion, he would not have been punished. It's interesting because sometimes very often life will force, you're going to be forced, in order to make it in this world, in order to achieve a certain level of perfection, you're going to confront your weaknesses, your defects. Everybody has their defects. But a person, some of his defects he's able to deal with and he can overcome. And then there are some which he doesn't want to face. Doesn't want to deal with them. That's it. And what he seeks to do is to avoid. And to avoid situations where you're going to have to deal with that weakness or with that defect. You try to avoid it. But then sometimes you can get away with it. Sometimes you can avoid. But I don't know. Reality just has a way of asserting itself. It's very hard. It seems to me that if you have a significant defect, the situation is going to bring that. You're going to face a situation where that's going to come to the fore. Yeah, like a moment of truth, so to speak. This is what happened to Elimelech. This was an opportunity for him to really perfect himself. But what did he choose to do? He chose to run away from the situation. He hoped longer to just avoid the situation. He couldn't confront that weakness within himself and deal with it. Had he been able to do so, this would have been an excellent opportunity. But he chose, and because it's interesting, a person could be a righteous person, he could be a tzaddik. And it would have remained so, but that's the way reality is. You can't You can't control the external situation. So therefore, it's always better, you should work on yourself. If you know that you have defects, you should work on yourself. Don't say, there's no real need to work on that because I'll avoid the situation, so I'll never have that problem. No. The problem will usually come up. It's going to come there. There's going to be a day of reckoning when you have to confront it. And he sought to escape from the problem. And in doing so, that was a big chet. For many reasons. See, it's interesting. It is tied in with the chet of the generation. If we're talking about Shvot HaShoftim in terms of Mishpat, which means an excessive attachment to the material. So that's the same thing that he had. He had a problem over here with the material. His attachment to materialism. But, I mean, for many reasons, for a Gadol HaDor to abandon Eretz Yisrael, the abandonment of Eretz Yisrael, because I'll say that's equivalent to Avodah Zarah. You see, he suffered tremendously. He had no idea. When a person's operating emotionally, when he can't confront certain emotions, then he's going to have to be rational. He's not thinking rationally anymore. Because he thought Logar, he thought it's going to be temporary. It wasn't Logar, by Yusha. He never had any idea when he left that his children would wind up marrying Moaviot, Gentile women. How could that be? He'll protect them. You see, once a person deviates, he thinks he can limit the damage. I'll just leave the land. That's all I'm doing. I'm just leaving the land. But everything else, my family, my children, I'll be able to control all that. See, once a person deviates, he's no longer functioning rationally. He loses control. He's just rationalizing now. He's not thinking clearly. He's just rationalizing now. I just want to mention one point, though. So what should he have done? I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, should he have given up his whole fortune or whatever? This is not really brought down to us. But you see, the emotion which caused him to leave, and leaving Eretz Yisrael is bad in its own right. But does it also partake? It seems to me, it's not just bad on the personal level. That is to say, on the personal level, because you need to live in the proper environment. And Eretz Yisrael is the land, which the society, of course, which represents the whole correct way of life. So if you're putting yourself amongst, as I said, if you're taking yourself from Eretz Yisrael, you're putting yourself in a place where everybody's living according to a false philosophy. So you're going to be destroyed. You're going to be affected by the philosophy. But is that the only thing, just concern, is that the only area, or is there another chet here? Yes?
Well, I was
going to
say,
separating from the cloud, it seems to me that herein also is a chet of injustice. This is something which very few people take full cognizance of. The fact that you have but you'll say, I had to leave. Let's forget about the fact that it's stingy, whatever the case is. I had to leave Eretz Yisrael to save my fortune. Alright? Yeah, but what about your debt? There's an injustice. Without Eretz Yisrael, you'd do nothing. Don't you have a debt to Eretz Yisrael? A debt to society? That's a very unpopular notion in our society. You know, the debt. We tend to think of it, you know, people are always griping about their debts to society. Is there a debt to society? Right? But you see, it's illustrated in a philosophical work I'll get to in a minute. A great philosopher illustrates this idea. You can learn from everybody. Is that even if it's true, I mean, I don't know, we're not passing a shadow of you. How much money would he have to give? You know, at what point? But even if it's true that you would have to give up your fortune, well, perhaps that's your chiyuv. You say, one second, why should I give up my fortune for... Why? Because justice. You wouldn't have an existence. You wouldn't have a life. You're acting as though you're doing everybody a favor. You're helping. But you have an obligation. Without this, is a whole society which has been established by many generations, by people. Without the society, there'd be no Elimach. Your values. He was a Gadol HaDor, all your Torah, your values, everything, only because of the society. You mean you can turn your back on the society and see it go down the drain? That's an injustice. It's a sin of injustice. Aside from there's the personal. Aside from the fact that you're putting yourself into danger. That's true. That's a personal thing. But the very fact that you're abandoning the society at a time, at this particular time, is an injustice because you have a chiyuv to the society. That's an egotistical thing. You're acting as though you're a great person in your own right. You didn't get it from society. People take it for granted. See, that's something that people tend to overlook in their life, their obligations of justice to society. It's a lot. You see, we don't focus on this too much. And yeah, this is family, to your family, your parents. People don't want to hear that. Not like that. They want to hear that. People don't like to hear that. Because today, people have, let's be honest about it. You know, all things being equal, people have a certain negative attitude towards parents. It's like you're doing your parents a favor. If you fail to recognize it, in terms of justice, where would you be? You, without your parents, they raised you and gave you an education, and this is a certain tendency, I know plenty of people that have that. Any fault that they have, they tend to ascribe to bad upbringing, blame on their parents. Because my parents forced me to do this, they did that, that's why I'm this way. So, because I'm perfect. And all the good, you'll never hear them give. If someone compliments them, how considerate they are, how intelligent they are, this, that, they'll never say, oh, it's because my parents are. They'll never go back and try and find what their parents did in youth to give them the good quality. Ah, wow, you know, I worked on that. It's very important to me, you know. And I always made sure, you know, from the time I was in. And I always worked on the quality. And that's just my nature. No, that's just the way I am. I'm not taking that, just the way I am. In other words, I'm perfect. So a person has the attitude that taking everything for granted, everything is coming from him because he's the center of reality. Everything that's the way the world should be, the world was made for him. The Shvili Nivra'ala. That's an area of people don't think about that enough. It was a lot of it. It affects a lot of things, institutions. There are people like it's not on parents; it's adults too. By the way, I don't mean to focus necessarily on youngsters or whatever. It's everybody. You see, people are always complaining, even about a school, about a shul, whatever it is, and they even fail to realize that. Look at all the chesed that was done for you. There are people that are dedicating their hours, lives, this, that. All right, so you don't like a certain thing. But there's no sense. There's very few people that sit back and really have a sense that I owe something, that I should help out, that I shouldn't be complaining all the time. I should have a certain realization of the overall picture over here that I'm taking. I've gained a tremendous amount. There's a chiyuv makar satov. So that would also come into the picture. It may be true that right now, it's a big thing to ask. You're giving up your fortune of money for the society. True. But there's a question of justice. Where would you be without the society? Now the society needs you. So that's a question of justice. I would say that he too partook of that particular breakdown. Okay, those are the first two ideas.